From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Arlene Violet. She capped her law career by becoming the first woman in U.S. history to be elected a state attorney general. That's a noteworthy achievement in itself. In Violet's case, it came after 23 years as a nun. Also today, I talk with Fresh Air's classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz. We'll learn more about Lloyd's approach to reviewing music and about his other love, poetry. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays some classic Mardi Gras music, and book critic John Leonard reviews Anthills of the Savannah, the new novel by Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Arlene Violet has several firsts to her credit. She was the first nun to earn a law degree in the state of Rhode Island, and in 1984, she became the first woman state attorney general in the country. But when she ran for office, she had to return to the secular life. Her bishop told her she had to choose between staying with her order, the Sisters of Mercy, or entering politics. During her 2-year tenure as an attorney general, Violet retried Klaus von Bülow, attempted to eliminate what she described as the mafia's middle management in her state, made victims' rights a priority, and tried to reform the plea bargaining system. Violet lost her bid for re-election and now works for a private law firm. She's written an autobiography. It's titled Convictions, My Journey from the Convent to the Courtroom. Welcome.
Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it.
In People magazine in 1979, they wrote a big feature story about you, and they gave you the nickname Attila the Nun, and that's kind of been used to describe you. And it makes me think that a lot of people think that there's some kind of basic contradiction in terms for a nun to be tough and to really be tough in the courtroom and to be a tough attorney general. Does that sound like it should be a contradiction in terms to you?
I hope not. And it is true. When I first got that title, it was really out of respect. I was clients that I was representing in a deinstitutionalization suit. I was representing mentally retarded citizens. After our first legal skirmish there, the people looked at me and said, today the other side has met Attila the Nun, meaning it in a complimentary style. But yes, it would seem that people consider that a contrast, that you can't be a nun and tough in the courtroom, too.
Well, do you feel that you were trained as a nun to not be assertive and to be accepting of authority? And was it hard for you to take on such an assertive role?
Just to the contrary. The Sisters of Mercy, which was the order that I entered and stayed with for 23 years, what I loved about them was they always told us to respond to the unmet need. And because the need is unmet, it means nobody has done that ever before. So they were constantly challenging us to risk, get out there, step out there on all the new frontiers to try to respond to people's unmet needs. So it was just the contrary.
I guess that early on in your career, your adversaries thought, oh, well, she'll be easy.
Yes, I think there's a stereotype of a nun where they think that you fell out of a Bing Crosby movie or something, you know. But I think as they get to know more nuns, particularly the Sisters of Mercy, they tend to be very, very assertive women, it seems to me, because they're there in the mainstream of life trying to assert people's lives and basic rights.
You tried to take on organized crime when you were an attorney general. This is a perfect example of people who you'd have to convince you were tough, A, as a former nun, and B, as a still a woman.
Yes, yes.
What were some of the things you had to do to prove that you could talk tough and be tough? What were some of the things you had to do?
Well, basically, I didn't try to prove myself in any way other than to try to do the job. And we focused on organized crime, number 5, 4, and 3 of organized crime. We got convicted. The drug kingpin, Mastracio in Rhode Island, received a 42-year sentence when we convicted him. And as we began those types of prosecutions, the message got out.
You didn't feel like you ever had to use any theater to show what you could do when you were working with organized crime?
I'm not sure relative to theater. I think I can only know that Raymond Patriarcher Jr., who was the alleged head of organized crime, told the Rhode Island State Police that he had a lot of respect for me because I just didn't go after organized crime, that the higher-ups, as he referred them, in public corruption, I was just as willing to take them on. So I had his grudging admiration. But no, I'm not sure if I used theatrics as much as what I really tried to do was to just be myself and try to do the job.
Now, during your career, you've sued a bishop and prosecuted priests. The bishop that you sued, it was before you were attorney general. He wanted to close down a Church One daycare center, and you didn't want him to do that. Now, I want to get to the authority thing again. Certainly in the church, you are taught to recognize and be obedient to authority, and it must have been very hard for you to turn around and sue a bishop.
Here's what was tough about it. I was obviously a nun at the time. The daycare center was in an area called Fall River, Massachusetts, which had the highest rate of unemployment. And the kids who came to the daycare center all belonged to women who were single parents who would work in these sweat mills, and but for these jobs and the dignity of those jobs, would be on the welfare rolls. And Terry, before I actually took that step to become involved in the lawsuit against the bishop, I had done inner city work. And when I was involved in inner city work, it was so cute. You know, people thought the nuns were cute when you were doing certain things. But once you began to take on the power structure, then I would see a priest here yanked from the inner city and a nun here yanked. And I said to myself, you know, what we were convincing the poor of is that when the going gets tough, the tough get going right out of here. And that was not going to be a message that I wanted those poor women to hear from me. So the bishop threatened us with excommunication and expulsion from the diocese. But for me, the decision was to be a Sister of Mercy in reality, even if it looked like I was going to be forfeiting the name. And I tried to stick, by the principle of sticking with the women.
That was in the post-Vatican II years.
Yes.
Did the reforms within the church help you stand up to authority?
I think the reforms did, and certainly always how the Sisters of Mercy interpreted theology. First, last, and always, the Sisters of Mercy felt the church was the people, and all authority came from the people, and anybody else in authority was really just the steward of the power of the people. So our mission as Sisters of Mercy was to empower people to be able to make decisions about their own lives.
One of the things you tried to do when you were Attorney General in Rhode Island was to reform or do away with, if you could, plea bargaining. Why did you want to do that?
I didn't want to do away with plea bargaining because it's a fact of life, but I wanted to make sure that there was some element of quality of justice. I mean, anybody will plea to a charge if you give away the store, but I wanted some parity between the nature of the crime and what the ultimate disposition was.
Another thing I want to ask you about, the first piece of legislation that you passed allowed people's entire records, including their records as a juvenile offender, if they had them, allowed these entire records to be weighed against them in court. Now, there is a tradition in court to keep previous offenses out of this trial. Why did you want to change that?
Here's what I wanted to change. The juvenile who was, in effect, a career criminal, if they continued their life of crime at age 18, they would then be treated as a first-time offender. That did not make sense to me. So under my legislation, the juvenile record could be used if it was a felony record and the person continued in the life of crime. It couldn't be wiped out then.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Arlene Violet, and she was the first woman state attorney general in America. This was in the state of Rhode Island. She was a nun for 23 years before she got elected to that position. She's written an autobiography which is titled Convictions, My Journey from the Convent to the Courtroom. I think a lot of Catholic girls grow up wanting to be nuns. Few of them actually do it. You did. What made you want to be a nun?
It's hard to say. I've been asked that question so many times, you know. I think basically I was impressed with the nuns that I had in grammar school. The rules were that at 3 p.m. they were supposed to be locked up in cloister, but instead I would see them out on the streets shaking down the butcher and the baker, you know, to get food for the hungry and so on. And frankly, I loved their spirit, that they had a sense of what living really was about as opposed to, quote-unquote, a rigid set of rules. And I think that sense of commitment to the community really impressed me, and I wanted to try it out.
How old were you?
I was 18 years old when I entered the Sisters of Mercy.
Did you really feel like you understood what it was going to mean in your life to to not get married and have children?
No, not at the time. I think as life went on and times went on, there were many challenges to understanding what that commitment meant. That's one of the reasons, Terry, why there's 8 years for you to make up your mind whether you want to stay with that.
And you did stay with it.
I did stay with it, yes. And fundamentally, people say, well, why then, after 23 years, did you leave it to, quote-unquote, you know, run for politics? And the obvious answer is I did it out of convictions. I had worked so many years with victims. I couldn't get the system to change. In my state, the only person who could do anything about that and set up a prototype model was the Attorney General. So from my perspective, I thought it was a nun-like thing to do, to try to make the criminal justice system victim-sensitive as opposed to constantly trashing the rights of victims.
Well, let's get back to that in a couple of minutes. You took your vows in 1969.
Yes.
That was one of the peak years of cultural and political upheaval and radicalism.
Absolutely.
In America. How exposed to that were you?
I think very exposed, particularly Vatican II mm-hmm. had come and gone. I obviously had always been interested in civil rights movements, and it happened to correspond perfectly in my own life that was opening up at the time.
So you would march in rallies and...
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Wearing your habit?
Yes, wearing a habit at the time. I can recall one time picketing on behalf of Cesar Chavez, and one of the fruit stores who recognized my habit, not me, cut out all the fruit and lettuce to the convent. So there was, even back in those days, I was learning very quickly that if you have a conviction, there's a price that you have to pay for it, and sometime your sisters in the convent have to pay a price, too, because of your activities.
Now, you lived for about 15 years, not in a convent, but in a housing project.
That's correct.
And what was your mission in the project?
Well, what we were trying to do is really to identify, frankly, as much as possible, although you can't. You know, if you have a doctorate of law, which I have, you really can't identify totally with poor people. But we wanted to be of assistance to improve the quality of people's lives. To do that, you have to know what the problems were. So at the various neighborhoods in which I lived, we were really trying to get firsthand experience on what it meant to be poor so we could know how to change the system.
Well, in your book, you write that you started to, let me see the words that you use, you started to develop the classic symptoms of the downtrodden. Let me ask you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, what would happen is the first place we lived was Hartford Avenue Housing Project, and the place was freezing, and then during the summertime it was just the opposite. And it was discouraging. You know, we came from homes where it was clean, and then you'd walk through the projects, and it was a very discouraging type of experience. As I say in the book Convictions, at least we nuns had each other to support, but you'd see the same people out of work, the same broken marriages, the same brawls, night in and night out, and it can really get to you.
What kind of environment had you grown up in?
I'd grown up in a warm, loving environment from parents who were terrific, my brother and sister who was great. I was the youngest child, so perhaps in some ways I was rather protected. But I think I grew up a lot when my father died when I was 14 because it really made me face the fact that I had to, in a sense, be a support to my mom since my brother and sister were both away at college at the time.
So you were living in a housing project in part to try to understand what the needs of the poor were. Were you seen by the residents of that project as someone who could help protect them or as someone that they needed to protect?
I think both. You know, I think they thought that we could protect them in some ways because I was a lawyer and I could live. But I think also they probably thought we didn't know how to get out of our own way in terms of living in those types of neighborhoods, so they tended to be protective toward us.
Well, did living in a housing project, do you think, educate you in how to, like, really kind of be assertive, stand up for yourself, and
it sure had
let
a
people
lot.
Know that you weren't going to be pushed around?
It sure had a lot to do with it, and part of it was, you know, from my perspective and why I eventually went to law school, is I saw how the system really, in my view, reinforced people staying on the bottom rung of the ladder. And, you know, I would represent a senior citizen or a consumer who saved up every penny and then something would be a lemon and so on. You know, and I'd go and they'd say, well, sorry, you can't do anything about this because the law is against it. And I said, well, I didn't know if the law was against it. If it was, it didn't strike me like it was a good social policy. So I went to law school to try to figure out what I could do about it. So in that regard, living there and having that experience, I got to know all the crush, really, that was on poor folk.
Whose permission did you have to get from the church before you went to law school?
The religious order, the Sisters of Mercy. I went and said, look, there's an unmet need. I don't know how to advocate for people because they have all these laws that's saying I can't do this for them and they can't do this for themselves. I want to go change that. And they said, fine, go ahead.
And how old were you when you were in law school?
I'm 28 or so. I graduated when I was 30.
So you weren't really that much older than most of the students there.
Right.
But were you still wearing a habit then?
No, I was not. I would wear a habit sporadically. For example, if I knew there was some senior citizen who wouldn't let anybody in and she was having some problem, I put a habit on as a way to get into the house to see if I could be of assistance to that particular senior citizen. But generally, no, I did not wear a habit in those days.
So now you were the first nun to get a law degree in the state of Rhode Island.
Yes.
Were you treated differently than the other students? Did you feel like an oddity while you were in school?
No, I didn't. In many ways, I felt my classmates were able to talk with me about things they wouldn't talk about to other people. You know, if they had fears about flunking or they wouldn't hesitate to ask for my notes and that type of thing. So it helped me in that regard as a nun to truly be a collegial person with them in law school. But I didn't think I ever got treated like I was any different otherwise.
My guest is Arlene Violet, and she was a nun for 23 years and then became the first woman to serve as a state attorney general. This was in the state of Rhode Island. She's written a new book. It's titled Convictions, My Journey from the Convent to the Courtroom. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Arlene Violet is my guest, and she is the former state attorney general in Rhode Island. So you were in law school. You'd gotten permission to do it. After law school, you worked for a while before you entered into politics. How did you first make that decision to go? And you were actually approached by the chair of the Republican Party in Rhode Island.
Yes, I was approached, but meanwhile, what had happened was I had begun to work with various victims of crime, and what I was seeing is that first they were devastated by the crime itself, but then when they got into the criminal justice system, 7 times later their case still wouldn't have been called. They had absolutely no say in what any disposition was of the crime or whatever, and they felt totally trashed all over again by the criminal justice system. I used to try so many ways, you know, through all the quote-unquote channels to try to get something done, and I couldn't. So in my own view, I was also looking for some mechanism to assist victims of crime, and it happened to fall into place when they approached me from the Republican Party to run for attorney general.
You mentioned in your book that most of the sisters were Democrats.
Oh, absolutely, but they came out to help me in the campaign.
Did you have any party affiliation before you were approached?
I have always split my vote. You know, my father was a Republican city councilman, but I definitely would split my vote, and still to this day split my vote.
Now, I think it was in 1980 that the Pope decreed that priests could not hold elected office. Was that decree supposed to apply to nuns as well?
There was a big question about that, which then got cleared up in 83, at Advent. What it said was that you were discouraged from running, from political office. And what would happen then is it was up to the local bishop to make that decision. Up until that time, the religious order head could make the decision, and the Sisters of Mercy did allow nuns to run for political office, the thought being that we Sisters of Mercy were supposed to be improving the quality of people's life, so for heaven's sakes, why not be in a legislature to fight bad laws to start with or promote good laws that did improve the quality of life? I guess that's one reason why I and other nuns got to go to law school, because then we could fight for good laws in the courtroom. So the Sisters of Mercy always felt that was a way of responding to unmet needs, but in 1983, the Pope took the decision-making, as it were, away from the major superiors.
So when you talked this over with your bishop, when you talked it over, you know, your interest in running for office, what did he tell you?
Well, the first time, I thought he was under the impression that I was running for Secretary of State, and it didn't seem to be a major problem with him. I told him, no, I was running as Attorney General, and about a week before I announced, he indicated that he wanted me not, in fact, to do that. That was in 1982, and I ran Terry, and I lost in 1982. Okay, and then when 1984 came around, still nothing had happened to improve the quality of victims' lives. The system didn't change. I felt compelled again to run, And this time when I brought it up to him, he said, in effect, that he had the power and the last word for sure now, and that I would have to give up religious life if I wanted to run for public office.
I think you imply in the book that you thought this was partly because the church was involved politically, that the church got money through groups that had political motivations, mm-hmm. got charitable money through groups that had political ties. Is that right?
The point I'm making in the book is that the church is not impervious to politics. Mm-hmm. It's just what politics is there. For example, in my view, the Pope has told the priests in Central America that politics, quote unquote, is out for them. But, I mean, certainly archbishops and cardinals preside at marriages of governors and governors' daughters and sons and so on. To me, that's a species of politics. So it's just an issue, in my view, as to what politics and whose politics.
When you decided that running for office was important enough for you to leave your order, the Sisters of Mercy, it must have opened up the doors to all these other changes that you had to decide if you wanted to make in your life.
Yeah, the decision for me wasn't to run for office, because I could care less, frankly, then as well as now about politics. But after seeing so many people and sitting in with so many victims' groups, I felt committed to try to change the criminal justice system for the victims. And by then, it was such a need that existed that I felt committed, and I had to take the step necessary to try to do something.
But still, I mean, that would open up the doors to all kinds of questions. Were you going to pray as many hours as you
used to? Oh, yes, I got all those questions.
Were you now going to maybe have a family, mm-hmm. you know, get married? It's so much to contend with all at once, a new professional life and then all these other possibilities. Did you think about those things immediately or put them off till you got acclimated to not being with the order?
Well, no, the real decision for me was to what degree did I want to put on the line the life I had for 23 years for the attempt, and not necessarily a given, because I didn't know if I was going to be elected. But to what degree did I want to risk all of that to try to do something about victims' rights? And that was really, for me, the only decision. I think what's important in life is to know what principles you're willing to live for and what principles you're willing to die for. And in some ways, the victims' issue for me was one that I was willing to, quote unquote, die for in terms of 23 years of my life. I felt that strongly about it.
Were there any open back doors, any hints that, well, if you failed in your bid for this election, you could come back in?
It was to the contrary. Many people who know priests and nuns know that sometimes a priest can try to run off and get married, and or nuns have fallen away and been allowed to come back. This particular bishop put the to me that I could never return, and he would put that on my papers if I made the decision. I like to think that he did that hoping I wouldn't run, and that it wasn't vindictive or anything of that nature. But I knew when I made the decision that was it.
How do you feel about it now? You got elected to state attorney general, but then you lost your bid for re-election, so now you're in a private law firm, mm-hmm. and you can't re-enter your order again.
When I made the decision, I knew I wasn't going to be able to re-enter the order, so I put that behind me. Again, it goes to that convictions, hence the name of this book. It goes to the conviction of if you believe in something, what's the price you're willing to pay for it? I knew back then that I had tried through all the channels to do something about victims' rights, and I was going to have to do it even if it meant I had to give up something I dearly loved.
But maybe there's no turning back anyways. Maybe after you leave the order and experience secular life that you wouldn't necessarily want to go back?
I think the Sisters of Mercy always experienced secular life because that was the nature of what the order was.
To be out
in the world and trying to respond to unmet needs. So it wasn't like I was any type of cloistered nun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a real being out there, and that's why I was a practicing lawyer doing public interest law for all those years. So I wasn't separated from the populace during the 23 years I was a nun.
So are you going to run for office again?
I don't know, Terry. I guess during this particular book tour, I'll give some thought to that. I won't rule it out in the future.
You feel a lot of practice in public speaking.
I don't know. But I've just got to figure out during the next couple of weeks or so whether I want to sit out a next round or whatever. I'll make a decision for these upcoming 2 years and then see what happens in the future. Just be open to possibilities.
You know what I'm curious about? I know back in 79 when this aforementioned People magazine article came out, the one that dubbed you Attila the Nun, that you got calls from media around the country, and you also got called
by an agent who wanted to handle you. And then you started getting calls about made-for-TV movies based on your life and this and that. Back in 1979, did you say to yourself, what the heck am I going to do with an agent? What is a nun and lawyer going to do with an agent?
I know. I did get one, Frank Cooper, who continues to be my agent today. Obviously, there was interest in doing TV movies, and of course the money for the rights and all that I turned over to the order. But it's not something, to be honest with you, that affects my life in the present. I know there's interest now in perhaps doing a television movie based on this particular book, but it's nothing I count on or anything of that nature.
Have you gotten to the point where you feel that there's two Arlene Violets, the real one, and then the made-for-TV version?
I don't know. I don't think there's two of me. I think there's only one of me. But there's such things as things that may be unreal in one's life. You know, the fact that Random House was interested in having me write a book because they thought I had an interesting life, that's sort of unreal to me.
Well, I'll tell you what was unreal to me. I was reading in an article, and you never know how true these things are, but I was reading in an article that, you know, Random House asked for you to write this book, and you had a co-author on
it.
And they had, what had interested them in the book was they had seen a 60 Minutes feature on you. And when they got the book back, it wasn't exactly the image that they had in mind from the 60 Minutes piece. They wanted someone else to write it and for it to conform more to the idea they had from 60 Minutes.
I think that was the statement of the author who was fired off the book, the co-collaborator. And the reason for that, by the way, is that writer was a tremendously talented woman, but she tended to write sarcastically, and Random House felt that in a 300 to 500-word column that she was used to writing, that works. But in a 10,000-word book, it gets a little bit heavy. I consider myself a feminist, but I happen to like men. And I felt that there was a certain edge in the book that really was the intrusion of the collaborator, because I wasn't feeling those hostile feelings that came through. So I think there was a little bit of ego involved in the final product there.
Let me ask you about dealing with ego yourself. I mean, one thing I know you are taught as a nun is humility. Is it easy to hold...
I didn't get that lesson too well, did I?
is it easy to hang on to that when you're, a high-powered lawyer and made-for-TV movies in the works?
I try not to take myself too seriously. You know, I must say a dozen times a week, life is too short. And the things I still value are my friends and all the people who've enriched my life. And I don't feel any differently, you know. My friends might debate that. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't think I'm basically different.
I just have one more quick question for you. Now that you're not in the order and haven't been for several years, is praying different? Is praying alone or in church as a lay person qualitatively different for you than it was, you know, praying as a nun and praying with your sisters?
No, I don't think so. I can remember one reporter asking me, did you go to church at Christmas, right after I'd made the decision? I said, yes. He said, did you feel awful? Because this was the first time in 23 years you had a Christmas time without being a nun. I said, no, because when I went to pray, I never said, God, this is Sister Arlene Violet, or this is Attorney General Violet praying to you. It's, hello, Arlene again, you know. And I don't have any of that type of thing.
Okay.
For better or for worse, I don't. I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us.
Thanks a lot for being
here. It's my pleasure,
Terry. My guest has been Arlene Violet, and she's the former State Attorney General of Rhode Island. She's written an autobiography. It's titled Convictions, My Journey from the Convent to the Courtroom. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Newsday reporter Mike McCallery. He's written the book Buddy Boys about police corruption in New York City. Two of the policemen who were involved in the corruption and then cooperated with the authorities will also be here, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, another side of Lloyd Schwartz. Fresh Air's classical music critic is also an accomplished poet. We find out more about Lloyd in the latest of our interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. And it's Mardi Gras time in New Orleans. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays a few appropriate tunes, courtesy of some New Orleans rockers. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new novel by Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe, set in a fictional African country. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Early returns from New Hampshire show Vice President George Bush ahead of Senate Republican leader Robert Dole in the nation's first primary. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis has opened up an early lead over his Democratic rivals. ABC and CBS have projected Bush and Dukakis the winners in tonight's primary. With 15% of the vote in, Bush had 38%, Dole had 26%, Dukakis had 31%, compared to Richard Gephardt with 23% and Paul Simon with 16%. An American member of the Irish Republican Army was convicted today in Britain of the murder 13 years ago of a British policeman. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports.
40-year-old William Quinn, who is from San Francisco, is the first member of the IRA ever extradited from the United States to Great Britain. He fought a celebrated 5-year legal battle against extradition, but finally lost in 1986 when the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear his case. Today, after deliberating less than 3 hours, a London jury found Quinn guilty of murdering an off-duty police officer on a London street in February 1975. The shooting, at point-blank range, occurred during a police chase. Quinn was said to be fleeing from an IRA hideout. Police later found a cache of bomb-making equipment and Quinn's fingerprints on a map and other items. Quinn maintained that he was innocent, although he had been convicted earlier in Ireland of being a member of the outlawed IRA. Today, in passing a life sentence, the judge said it was an appalling, cold-blooded killing for which Quinn had shown no remorse because of his terrorist activities. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
A former Conrail engineer accused of running a stop signal and driving 3 freight locomotives into the path of an Amtrak passenger train pleaded guilty today to 1 count of manslaughter. 16 people were killed in the January 1987 accident in Maryland. The state agreed to drop 15 other manslaughter counts against Ricky Gates, saying the plea bargain arrangement assured a criminal conviction, which sends a message to all people in public transportation. Gates today apologized to the families of the victims for his actions, but said more needs to be done to ensure safety.
I have accepted my responsibility by pleading guilty today. I hope the railroads will accept their responsibility by correcting unsafe conditions and dangerous situations that exist.
Federal investigators have said Gates failed to notice the stop signals because he was smoking marijuana and possibly drinking alcohol. Congress checked in on the Internal Revenue Service today to see how taxpayers and the IRS are coping under the first year of the new tax law. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports on today's hearing on Capitol Hill.
Commissioner Lawrence Gibbs said the IRS learned its lesson the hard way from its experience with the W-4 form last year. The form was revised after complaints that it was too complicated. Gibbs said the IRS learned to avoid putting out forms that the public can't or won't deal with. The new 1040 forms and its variations have been tested by consumer focus groups. Gibbs says emphasis was placed on training IRS employees to deal with taxpayer questions about the new law and the new forms. But he says a taxpayer is still responsible for paying additional taxes, even if that's the result of erroneous information given by an IRS counselor.
If a taxpayer receives erroneous information from the Internal Revenue Service and it results in additional tax penalty interest, we are not able to waive the additional tax. We will waive the additional penalty.
Gibbs says the IRS is looking into whether it can waive the interest on the taxes, but that question has not been resolved. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Stock prices staged a strong advance today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 22 points to close at 2005.8. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today, New Orleans is celebrating Mardi Gras, the 24 hours plus before the 40 days of Lent. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward may be in Texas, but he's still in the Mardi Gras spirit.
I don't need to remind anybody in the state of Louisiana, it's Mardi Gras time. Out in the countryside, Cajuns are running their careers, horseback processions of masked men who pretend to steal food from farmers to make a big gumbo, which is served at a dance at the end of the day. And in New Orleans, they celebrate Mardi Gras with rock and roll. Oh, I know that a lot of tourists have already decided that the appropriate soundtrack is Pete Fountain or the superannuated men at Preservation Hall. But for the people who actually live there, Mardi Gras and the local popular music have been synonymous since the early 50s. That was when a legendary piano player, Roy Bird, known to one and all as Professor Longhair, first recorded his anthem, Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Actually, the song has a long and twisted history, having been cut in 1949, 1950, 1952, 1958, and many times subsequently. It's catchy and shows off Longhair's patented rumba boogie technique nicely. Here's the 1950 version. Because Longhair's record was so hard to find at first, other local musicians knew they could make a killing if they could just come up with another great Mardi Gras song. In 1955, the Hawkettes, whoever they were, did just that with Mardi Gras Mambo.
Down in New Orleans where the blues were born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On the side and Rampart Street, the combos play with the mambo beat. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo. Down in New Orleans, in Great Town where the cats all meet, it's the Mardi Gras mambo with the beat. Shout and cheer for the Zulu King. And truck on down with the mambo swing. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo. Down in New Orleans.
Actually, I know one thing about the Hawkettes, and that is that Art Neville, of New Orleans' amazing Neville family, was a member. There are plenty of Nevilles, as any of you who've gone to see the Neville brothers can attest, since they tend to hire family, and you never seem to see the same ones twice. This means that once you start getting into cousins and uncles, you find yourself squarely in the middle of a Mardi Gras secret society. Now, I'm not talking about the crews here, those groups who parade with huge floats and throw stuff to the crowds. Uptown, the Mardi Gras is different, and for years there have been several tribes of black Indians, groups who get together to dress in fantastically ornate costumes and do traditional chants.
Meet me boys on the battlefront. Meet me boys on the battlefront. Meet me boys on the battlefront. Pretty wild chopper Judah gonna stomp some rump.
Well, the prettiest little thing that I ever seen. Mardi Gras Indian down in New Orleans. Sold all night and he sold all day. Mardi Gras morning went all the way.
Meet me boys on the battlefront. Meet me boys on the battlefront. Meet me boys on the battlefront. Pretty wild chopper
are gonna stomp some rump.
Indians coming from all over town. Big Chief singing, gonna take 'em down. Jackie Mofito, Eli, hey. Indians are rulers on the holiday.
The Wild Chapatula's chant, Meet the Boys on the Battlefront, sums up New Orleans Indian life with the competition between tribes, the boasting, and the odd language, which showed up in another famous rock and roll hit.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, Ike-o, Ike-o, Ande. Giacomo Fino Anane, Giacomo Finane. Look at my king all dressed in red. Ike-o, Ike-o, Ande. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Giacomo Finane. Talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now. Ike-o, Ike-o, Ande. Giacomo Fino Anane, Giacomo Finane.
With its talk about flag boys and kings, the Dixie Cups' Ike-o, Ike-o was Mardi Gras Indian to the core. But it got to be a big hit in 1965, even among people who didn't know what Giacomo Finane means. That includes me. Although New Orleans has a tendency to mummify its musical traditions, during Mardi Gras they live in the streets, in the clubs, and at parties. And isn't that where you're supposed to find rock and roll?
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air listeners know Lloyd Schwartz as our classical music critic. Readers of the Boston Phoenix also know Lloyd's music criticism. But Lloyd has another side to his professional life. He's a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And in the literary world, he's gaining more and more recognition as a poet. Today we find out more about Lloyd as part of our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. First, I asked Lloyd how he started listening to classical music.
I think it was mainly listening to classical music on the radio, though my mother had a few 78s. And I got very interested in opera, I think because of the Met broadcast and the Voice of Firestone. And I actually made my parents buy me some complete operas when I was around 11. And I would, you know, sit in a corner and put them on the record player and read along with the libretto. And
when you started writing about classical music, did you want to do things different from the way they had been done? Did you want to take a different kind of approach to writing about classical music than you were used to reading?
I knew that I wanted to write in as direct and colloquial a way as possible. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to use a lot of complicated terms. And because I wasn't a musician myself or a musicologist, I always felt very uncomfortable with that kind of terminology. My impulse was to try to, you know, talk to the reader on the page.
You know, one of the things our listeners probably don't know about you is that you write a lot of poetry, some really, really good poetry.
Oh, thank
and
you.
There's a collection of your poems called These People. Mm-hmm. And the first piece is kind of a prose poem, really. And I just want to read the first sentence. The piece is called Childhood. And the first sentence is, in the imaginary kingdom of my only childhood, I played all the parts, male and female, human and animal. And reading that made me really wonder if you led a very rich fantasy life when you were a kid.
I did. I was an only child.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there were characters, and I talked to them, and I played them. I acted them with myself.
You know what strikes me? A lot of people who write in one way write in one capacity or another, at one point in their lives really wanted to be poets, and then kind of jumped ship on that idea. Yeah. And a lot of these people look back and laugh at the days when they thought that they would be a poet. And I think part of the reason why they laugh is that their idea of being a poet was wrapped up in all kinds of romantic imagery. Did you ever go through a phase like that where being a poet meant things far beyond actually writing, you know, where there was this whole mysterious persona wrapped up in it?
That always put me off.
Did it?
No, I never, I don't think I ever felt that. I think I started wanting to be a poet when I started to understand that poetry meant something.
Maybe that's why you stuck with it.
Yeah, well, I loved it. I just absolutely fell in love with poetry, with Keats. First of all, I was a senior in high school, and I thought, this is amazing. This stuff, it's not only beautiful, but it really means something. It means something very deep. And I didn't think I could ever approach that, but it certainly made me want to participate in it in some further way than just reading it, than just passively.
I'm going to ask you to read one of your poems. It's a poem called Simple Questions. And this is a poem that was nominated by Joyce Carol Oates for a Pushcart Prize, and it's featured in this year's Pushcart Prize anthology. It's a fairly long poem, so I'll ask you to read an excerpt of it, and maybe you could put the excerpt in context for us before you read it.
Sure. Well, it's a sad, painful poem, sad poem about, it's an elegy for my father. And most of the poem takes place in the hospital. He'd had a stroke. And I'm not sure whether we thought that it was better that he pulled through or that he didn't pull through. So it was a very difficult situation. I'm sure many people have gone through it. And I was not on very good terms with my father. But I was in the position where I had to try to work with him to try to get him to talk. And that's what that's mainly what the poem is about. And then he died in the hospital. And he dies at the end of the poem. And this is a section where I'm thinking about what it is that I have to do with him in the hospital. No love lost. A lifetime of anger, resentment, disapproval. Could I pretend, even now, a deep personal concern? Prodding him to speech, what the doctor ordered, to recover enough of his mind to help my mother endure his release. Hypnotized me. Gripped my attention the way his right hand gripped my hand, the last remnant of his unrelenting, fist-clenched denunciations of the world, of the Hitler brothers who refused him even a moment's rest in the sweatshops where he spent his working life stitching men's clothes, of relatives or neighbors never generous or grateful enough for someone rarely generous or grateful. Of my friends, of me, stymied by my anger, resentment, disapproval. The way his right hand gripped the hedge cutter, lifted it, and aimed it at my head. Quote, I have to go now. Goodbye. I'll see you tomorrow. Do you hear me? Feel better. I hope you feel better.
That's a beautiful poem, Lloyd. And I'm sure it was a very difficult one to write, in part because of the honesty of emotion that you're expressing. I think it's a very difficult thing to express anger about someone who you also really loved, you know, your father.
Yeah. It was very painful to write. I started writing it shortly after he died and worked on it for a long time.
Is it hard to commit something like that to the page, to be that honest emotionally?
A lot of the other poems are in the voices of other characters, and I think partly as a way of getting some objectivity and not having to just deal with your own, you know, actual feelings every moment.
You know, do you have your poem, your book of poems, These People?
Yeah.
There? Let me ask you to read, like, real quickly, like, the first few lines of, how about Estelle's Testimony? How about just the first few lines of that? It's just such a difference from what you just read.
All right. Well, this is, it's in the voice of a woman also. Here's the beginning of it. They said I was promiscuous. Did I get it right? That means sleeping around? Well, I am. And why not? I don't take money or anything. I just like sex and being sexy.
I think that really gives a great sense of the kind of different voices and different moods that you're capable of getting in your poems.
You know, I think it is a way of dealing with, I mean, I think I started that poem wanting to write a poem about my own feelings about sex, and I wasn't really ready to do that in my own voice. It was easier to do that, I discovered, in the voice of someone else, and someone who, at least in a kind of overt way, was very different from me.
Do you think that your poetry helps you be a sensitive critic because you know what it's like to have your work make you very exposed? You know what it's like to be vulnerable when you read a poem because it's your words and your emotions on the line there. Just as when you're reviewing a musician's performance, I mean, they're putting themselves on the line.
Yeah, I think in even a more exposed way than a writer does. But, well, I like to think that I'm hard on myself, so I want to be sympathetic. I don't think I'm an easy critic either, though.
Okay, Lord, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Fresh Air classical music critic Lord Schwartz spoke to us from NPR station WGBH in Boston. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what's coming up in the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
How are you covering the New Hampshire primary?
Well, tonight we'll have a number of stories, and we begin our coverage with an interview I did with the editor of Yankee magazine, John Pierce, on the New Hampshire personality. The state motto there is live free or die, and John Pierce thinks people in his state would be happy if were added to that motto a comma and the word damn it. He says there are a lot of independent types in New Hampshire. Robert Siegel, my co-host, also speaks with another Pierce columnist, Neil Pierce, who explains why New Hampshire is not like any place else, and we'll have coverage from our political correspondents.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Since the publication of his 1958 novel, Things Fall Apart, Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe has been recognized throughout the world for his depictions of African life, politics, and history. He's also taught and written poetry, essays, and children's books. After a long hiatus from novel writing, Achebe has written Anthills of the Savannah. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
It's been more than 20 years between novels for Chinua Achebe, the grand old man of African letters. Readers who remember Things Fall Apart, Arrow of God, and A Man of the People will expect just enough tribal folklore to satisfy our taste for the exotic in a narrative otherwise traditionally European. Like his fellow Nigerian, Wole Soyinka, Achebe has always seemed to write more for the West than for the home folks. One may have grown up Igbo and the other Yoruban at opposite ends of their country and on opposite sides of the Biafran Civil War, but both went to English schools and have had to define themselves in opposition to a departed colonial power. Despising that power, they still sought its literary approval. But in Anthills of the Savannah, Achebe has decolonized himself. He isn't much interested in more bashing of the British and other imperialists. He looks savagely inward instead, at the black elites of emerging Africa, fatally compromised in their association with the West, tone-deaf to the homeland. About the fictitious new nation of Kangan, He's at first funny, then sarcastic, then sad, and finally almost mystical. Ant Hills is the story of three schoolmates who come to power after the British flee, and the woman who loved two of them. Sam, a graduate of Sandhurst, the English West Point, is the leader of his people by military coup. Sam's best friend, the worldly Chris, is Minister of Information. Chris's best friend, the poet and prophet Ikem, edits the government newspaper. The peasantry in a drought-stricken north begins to stir. Sam's power corrupts to paranoia. Ikem's editorials and speeches lead to his arrest. The fabric of Chris's loyalties and life is torn. Beatrice, an economist in love with Chris and devoted to Ikem, moves from the salons to the streets to help. And in these ant hills, among shop girls, taxi drivers, and waterfront itinerants, it is no longer possible to blame the British for all that's gone wrong, nor to think that Marxist models are anything more than mirror tricks. The face of the desert is unchanged. Reading the minds of the intellectuals, Achebe finds an alienation from old gods and modern reality. They can speak, if they must, the pidgin English of the underclass, magnificently rendered here, a sort of mythic incantation, but no longer feel the contours this peculiar poetry describes. They've been so long among abstractions that they don't know how to connect, much less serve. They've ripped out roots they should have nourished. Somehow, out of pidgin, folktale, and bush dream, out of satire and despair, out of rites of burial and rebirth, Achebe in this short, wise novel makes a commanding affirmation. Beatrice and her symbolic daughters have vanguard roles to play in a new Africa. What will it look like? Achebe doesn't specify. When Ikem is asked by students to graduate from criticism to, quote, the higher responsibility of prescriptions for the future, he replies, writers don't give prescriptions, they give headaches. Ant Hills is a brilliant headache, cured by magic.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Ant Hills of the Savannah by Chinua Achebe. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll talk with black South African jazz singer Sadama B. Benjamin. She's led her own groups and has recorded with her husband, pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording of Leonard Bernstein's opera, A Quiet Place. It's the sequel to Trouble in Tahiti, his 1952 satire of suburban life. And humorist Al Gingold will remember a recent rite of passage into adulthood, the purchase of his first sofa. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Ruth Harold, Gavin Morrison, Kathy Anderson, and Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.